are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Hi, welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Winding down a chaotic week on the cusp of the weekend. Lots to talk about. We'll do so in our free-flow pop culture convo, including the latest developments, and there are some arrests of police officers to note in the Baltimore situation. We'll talk about that a bit later. Bernie Sanders says he's in. How will that help or hurt Hillary Clinton's run for the presidency? Weigh in. It'll also mark a milestone and a tragic event in American history. And just for fun, think about this question. What do Sandra Day O'Connor, Julie Taymor, and Miss Piggy have in common? I'll tell you. Also, get well wishes for Joni Mitchell and you in the mix if you're listening live. It is Friday, May 1st, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. 24/7 Twitter feed abuzz at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by Audiophile. From music to books to podcasts, caress your ears with everything you want to hear at Audiophile. Also by Walgreens. Enjoy great savings at the corners of healthy, happy and healthy. There you go. It's a crazy day for sure. And delighted to welcome our guest to the show. Really an honor to have Dr. Susan Ball with us. She is an associate professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College and assistant director at the Birnbaum Unit Center for Special Studies at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She's an internist who has been on the front lines of treating AIDS patients for over 20 years, and she really has seen it go from a certain death sentence and a social stigma to a manageable chronic disease, still with issues, medical and personal and public, for her patients. She chronicles it in this very intriguing, often poignant book called Voices in the Band, A Doctor, Her Patients, and How the Outlook on AIDS Care Changed from Doomed to Hopeful. It's really an honor and privilege to welcome Dr. Susan Ball to the show. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's so great to have you here. Congratulations on this book, which I guess, and I think you admit in the one of the introductions in the book, that you borrowed the title from Randy Schultz's fantastic book,
Yeah, definitely was influenced by that great book, And the Band Played On.
And the Band Played On, yeah. Great book. I mean, for those of us who came of age, like in the 80s, as a young person, I remember just hearing about what AIDS was first. I mean, it was so perplexing. I actually heard about it from a young friend of mine who was gay, who talked about this murky gay cancer that was contagious, and we were all baffled by this. How is cancer contagious? Nobody really had a name for it in the early 80s. Sadly, that young man never lived to see 30, and so many of us have lost friends along the way who just didn't make it, and it kind of decimated, this plague decimated certainly the arts community in New York, San Francisco, throughout the country, and various other pockets of the community, as you well know. Talk about, and you have this great way of, and I know you do say in the book that the patients are composites, you change names except for your name and the one of your colleagues, another doctor, but you do indicate how individual all these people are. They have their personal struggles, they have great personalities, there's humor, yes, there's grace, there's great struggle and pain. So we'll talk some about those personal stories, but let's talk about your story a little bit. How did you... Were you drawn into treating AIDS patients at that particular time in the early 90s? You had been an internist for a couple of years. Was it something, when you were in medical school, were you even thinking about? Were you aware of? I mean, how did you get lured into it?
I think we're probably about the same age because, for me too, in the early 80s when I was just starting in medical school, I heard about this infection from another medical student who was at school in New York, and I was in Philadelphia at the time. And this was in 1981 and 82, I think. And the disease was presenting itself with clusters of men, gay men, who were coming down with these very strange illnesses. So when I was in college, I never even had heard of it, and it was then through medical school that it became apparent that this was something that was real and was getting worse and worse. And the HIV itself was identified by about 1984, 85. So it, through residency, it wasn't something that I had initially envisioned at all when I wanted to be a doctor. It wasn't at all to take care of AIDS patients because I didn't even know anything about it. I really had wanted to, my career path was toward looking, I was looking toward working in global health, and I wanted to go and work potentially in Africa or in some underserved nation. And as I began my work in internal medicine in New York City at a different hospital, it became apparent that these patients with HIV and AIDS, who I'd seen a lot of in my residency also, but these were people who were very sick with a lot of very different, all kinds of different infections or cancers. And they were also very isolated in their diagnosis. So people were, there was such a stigma, and a lot of people didn't want to take care of these patients. And it became clear that this was an underserved population, and that I didn't really need to go to Africa to take care of people who really needed help. And I found also colleagues who were interested in the same process, really, taking care of these patients. And it was at a time when I think HIV sort of brought out the best and the worst in medicine, because some patients were turned away from hospitals, or the healthcare workers, the food people would leave the trays outside of the doors. So it wasn't a proud time for a lot of medicine, but the people who did want to be involved were committed and dedicated and really great colleagues, and I was very fortunate to find the Center for Special Studies and begin my work with HIV in 1992. That's a long answer to your question.
Yeah, no, that's great. No, no limit. But yeah, that was that whole fear factor of people not wanting to, you know. And then Larry Kramer brings out so beautifully in his Play the Normal Heart,
That's exactly right.
They put it on, you know, TV, a televised version on HBO, so a lot of people saw that. How the medical people really were so afraid of it. It's sort of like akin to what people went through briefly with the Ebola scare.
Exactly. That's a great parallel. Yes, we saw that. I remember very clearly when I was a resident, going to see a patient who we were quite sure had this infection, and the resident put on booties, gown, glove, mask, face mask, and I said, "Why are we doing all this?" And he said, "We don't know where this is coming from, or how they got it, or they could have some other infection that we could get." So that all of that gear that we put on, that also sort of isolated the patients from their providers. And that was, you could see, these are patients who are our age. You know, they were young people for the most part. And that, I think that separation of all that gear, all the gowns and gloves and masks, and that fear that people projected of being around patients with HIV, that was so isolating for the patients.
But you can see it. I mean, you can see why that would happen. I mean, because it's human nature. We don't know what this is. What do we do? How do you protect it? I mean, because
that's
if you
right.
talk about Ebola, the reason why it was transmitted so rapidly in certain places was because they didn't necessarily take the proper precautions. So
that's
we didn't know.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And then, but it became apparent once we knew what the virus was and how it was transmitted, then it became clear you could, you know, touch a patient or hug them or, you know, put your hands on, your bare hands on them without worrying about being infected. I know my parents were concerned initially when I started working with patients with HIV. They worried that I might get infected, and I reassured them that really it's a blood and body fluid way of transmission, and that was not a way of contacting the patients that I was going to be having.
It took a while for everybody to catch up, because once you have that fear, that grips it. You know, that fear is such a gripping force. But it's interesting that you mention the name of your unit, which is still the same name. It's the Center for Special Studies.
Yes.
I'm guessing, and I think you do talk about it in the book, that they named it such because nobody wanted to have the word AIDS. Nobody wanted to be affiliated
again
with that. It was ashamed of that, you know, the whole...
That's right.
You know, yeah.
That's right. So many clinics that opened in that time, the late 80s, early 90s, patients didn't want to have the stigma of being seen going in and out of an HIV center. They didn't want HIV on any of the mailings or any of the documentation that they got, because, you know, patients were losing their jobs, losing their insurance. People really were not wanting to be acknowledging having this infection. And even still, there's a lot of stigma that patients experience in different parts of their communities.
Exactly. But you really saw things change, because with the new advent of treatments, at some point, it was mid-90s, late-90s, when things, you got, you know, some medicine that would make it livable, that you could manage this disease depending on what stage you were at, obviously. And
that's,
if the patient
complied. That's really where I wanted to write this book, but, you know, Voices in the Band really covers that time in the 90s, and really the arc of the story is how in that period of time, in that decade, we went from really those very dark days of having no treatment to being able to effectively treat and control the virus and allow patients' immune systems to recover and to be healthy. And we now consider HIV really as a chronic disease for those who get into care and take their medication. Really, it's a huge difference.
Do you have an emergency in the background?
No, I'm all right. All right, thanks.
Okay. I never know. You're talking to a doctor. You might have a beeper goes off.
I know. I can't help that other phone from ringing. I'm sorry. But it's
no,
okay.
No problem. Tell me a little bit about your own journey, though, in treating these people, and what emotional toil and toll did it take on you? Because in the early days, as you said, it was pretty hopeless.
Yeah.
What kept you going? Was it the fact that you just felt called to do it, or the patients themselves? Give us some insight into what it's like to be a physician in that situation.
I think for me it was two things. It was, on one hand, the patients themselves, the stories that they brought to us, their lives, that sort of intimate way in which you get to know someone when you're taking care of them on that level. But also the team approach that I have here at the Center for Special Studies, with this multidisciplinary group where we have social workers, we have nurses, we have nutritionists, psychiatry. We had a chaplain full-time with us for a while. So that team approach really enabled us to care for so many of the other aspects of the patient's needs that might be paramount for them in a given moment. For example, they may have a lapse in their insurance, or may have a lapse in their electricity at home, and helping them with some of these other aspects of their lives was really important, but also to sort of disseminate those intense moments. You know, if patients were dying, or if there was a family that was losing a parent or losing a child, being able to talk about that with colleagues and share that experience with other people was super important, and still is. And I think that really was something that really kept all of us from getting just too overwhelmed by so much emotion in that time.
Yeah, it must be. I mean, just it's such heartbreak, because, as you said, some of these people were so young, and you had to deal with their families and some of the requests they had, et cetera.
Talk about some
of the patients. Yeah, go ahead. No, sir.
No, I was going to say, just as you experienced with your friend, who, as you say, didn't make it to 30. I mean, so many people were dying, particularly in those early days in the early 90s, and so there was just so much heartbreak around so many of these situations that it really was helpful to have other people to lean on and to support each other, and as well as supporting the patients, of course.
And you found humor in it too. I think that was also key, because humor, I always find, helps you through a lot of adverse situations.
And there were
some, you know, humorous things that happened and humorous incidents. Tell us about some of your most challenging or endearing patients. I mean, who stands out to you?
There's a patient I wrote about in the book. Her name was Peaches, and she was just a riot, and she just struggled so much. So it was she had a tough life. She had three young boys in her home, and she really struggled with crack use. And she lived in a bad neighborhood, and people were luring her with crack from time to time. And at one point, the boys were taken from her because of drug use. She got herself clean and got the boys back, but she still was in the same neighborhood, so she really struggled. And she would come into my office, and her hair would be a mess, and her clothes would be, you know, untidy, and she'd plop herself down in the chair in my office, and I was trying to get her to take some AZT, or I was trying to get her to take some Bactrim to prevent infections, and she just really struggled to take any medicine. She outright refused to take AZT because one of her friends had died after taking AZT from HIV. Really, it wasn't from the AZT, but, you know, in her mind, the AZT was a bad thing, and so she didn't want to take it. And so it was really a struggle to take care of her, because she would miss appointments.
So AZT is bad, but crack was okay in her.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, it's just she just really struggled in so many aspects of her life, but she just was a very just colorful and funny and irreverent, and we all really, really enjoyed her, and were happy that when she would come and tried hard to help her. Our social worker really worked hard to try and get her transportation to come to the clinic or get her some help with the kids, and, you know, in many ways trying to give her some support. She was a single parent as well. So she was a very, very lovable, very colorful character. Once I called her, I talked to her on the phone. I called her about something, and she used the F word so many times on the phone. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that someone could use the F word so many times on the phone. And it was just kind of funny, you know. I just was like, "Are you all right? Are you going to come and visit me?" And every other word was the F word. It was pretty funny.
Well, you obviously don't watch enough reality TV shows and reality TV shows yet. If you haven't heard the F word used that often.
I guess not.
But yeah, that's so interesting because you had such an up-close personal relationship with so many of these people, and you saw their uniqueness, and you managed to find the time, because I don't know if people realize, I mean, a lot of people do know that doctors are overburdened, and the patient's complaint would be the doctors don't spend enough time, but you tried, you fought with that, you know,
yeah.
You struggled to make sure, I have to keep up with this, but I also want to give this patient time. I mean, in all your little scenarios that you indicate, you write about in the book, where you're saying what your schedule is and what you have to do, but you still take the time because it's important, and that bedside manner you clearly have.
Yeah, sometimes it just was important. It didn't necessarily have to be an hour, but sometimes it just was important to sit down next to a patient when they were in the hospital at the bedside and hold their hand if that was the appropriate thing to do, and just sit and listen for 5 minutes. It could really make a very big difference for a patient. Sometimes you needed to sit for a lot longer than that, but just trying to just show that you were there and you're present and wanted to really be with that person and hear what was going on for them. And again, some with the families, sometimes we ended up spending, you know, a fair amount of time with the families as well, because sometimes the patient might have dementia or have terrible fevers and not be conscious, and so then we needed to spend time with the families as well. But yeah, that was important always to show that alignment with our patients.
Yeah, you never knew what was going to happen or who we were going to encounter, I guess, and what kind of mood they were going to be in. I mean, sometimes patients, because of the dementia, would have outbursts, and I think one scene with a guy that was sort of commandeering the floor, and he was upset because he didn't get his lunch on time, or he didn't like his lunch or something.
That's right. Oh my gosh, that guy! Yes, he threw the chair through the window. That was wild. Yeah, he had a very low patience quota. His patience threshold was exceeded pretty rapidly. He needed some extra TLC to get him through that, I think.
I mean, did you ever have anybody burn out from the staff who just said, "I really can't take this. I got to go. I just can't do it"?
Well, I would say I'm thinking of one of the doctors who left after a couple of years, and I think it was because of that. The person didn't exactly say I'm burned out, but I think there was just too. It was just too exhausting for that particular person, I think. There was a fair amount of turnover among the social workers. I think mostly, though, because they were quite young and doing different things in their careers. But, you know, I've been at my job now for 23 years. My colleague Stan, who I wrote about, he's been here 1 year longer, and he's still around. And two of my other colleagues have been here more than 15 years. So, I think again that team approach really has really helped us all to stick with our commitment and our be able to do the thing that we want to do. So having that team has been really so great for us.
Did you have any moments yourself where you thought about it? You know, I just can't do it. I want to do something else. I want to go in a different direction.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. From time to time, I definitely couldn't lie to you about that. It you know, it's sometimes feeling like this is this is too hard. There's, you know, I can't, I want to do something a little bit different. But then the next day comes and you see an old patient who's been around for a long time, and you realize you have this really, you have this long relationship, and that's something that's really very, very wonderful. So so that keeps me going.
And they're making it now, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Going through and longer.
That's
and,
right.
And
I think of it a little bit as a minefield for some of my patients who've been positive for years and years. You know, if they got through the 90s, or certainly some of them were infected in the 80s, if they got through that period of time, and you couldn't really predict who was going to do well and who was not, because so many people did not do well. But I have a few patients who really have, you know, they've been infected upward more than 20 years, and were around in the time before there was effective medicine, and then once the medicine became available, they got on their regimens and they take their medicine and they are living their lives, just doing, you know, doing their thing. And
that's a whole different kind of, you know, mind game for these patients too, I think, because they were sort of condemned themselves to this death sentence, or resigned themselves to it, I should say, and
that,
then they had to switch and say, wait a minute, I really have some life left to live, and what am I going to do with it, right?
That's right. That's a great point. You're making me think of one patient who I have who's still around, and she, when I saw her in, I remember in 1994, I remember she was telling me she'd bought something, and she was racking up this big credit card debt, and I said, why are you racking up this big credit card debt? And she looked at me and she said, well, I'm going to die, so I'm not planning on paying it back. And, you know, she's still around, so it came around to kick
her.
Did
she pay it back?
Yeah. Well, I actually didn't ask her.
Still paying
but,
it back.
But you're right. You know, people cashed in their life insurance policies because they just thought, you know, this is the end. I'm not going to make it. I'm just, you know, I'm going to might as well just take advantage of the little time I have left. And some of those patients are, you know, they're like, look at me. I never thought I would be 50 years old, or I never thought I'd make it to 60. And I have patients who are in their 60s now. It's just remarkable.
Amazing, yeah. They managed to turn that corner and they're still alive. And just,
yep.
Yeah, it's intriguing to see how they handle those life changes and reality that they do have life to live. And if they do make good choices, I'm sure it's a potpourri of some people
yes.
make better choices, some people not, just like, you know, anything in life. You know,
that's absolutely
when you go
right,
through
yeah.
something. Yeah, you know. You had one patient, it was funny, I forget what name you gave him again. You said, I think you made it pretty clear that you tried to make a composite, although, you know,
right.
people who work there might be able to identify who they were. But
exactly.
There was one patient who kept calling you Dr. Bowles, and you said, no, it's singular, so he called you Dr. Singular.
Yes. Yes, he was the lovable fellow. Yes, it was hilarious. Really, the guy he greeted me, Dr. Balls, and I said, "It's singular," and he said, "Oh, okay, Dr. Singular." But by the next day, he called me Dr. Balls again. So I didn't. It was a pretty ingrained impression on him.
That was
yeah.
pretty funny. Well, maybe he was pulling your leg. He knew when he was running it.
I'm not so sure about that.
No, you don't think so. You don't think so. Now, let's talk about, you know, writing this book, because you were writing this book for a while. It took you a while because, by the way, you had a very important day job, and you were still working full-time when you wrote it. Is that correct?
That's right.
For those
yeah.
of
that's
a lot of listeners who are writers or aspiring writers who can't find the time, and this is a great example. This is a woman who has a very important day job, and she managed to find the time. It did take a while, but what made you want to write it first of all, and then finally get over that hump to get it done?
Well, for me, it was being part of the narrative medicine program at Columbia. I had the book about halfway done, I would say, and I started writing it in about 2004. So after about 2 years, I felt like I had it about halfway done, and then I got sidetracked and put it down for a while. But in 2009, I went back to Columbia to the Master of Science degree in narrative medicine. And as part of that program, I worked with a writing teacher, a writing coach, Lynn Sharon Schwartz, who's an author, and she helped me just revise the first half and plug hard to get the second half done. And so in that process over the next 2 years, I wrote the second half of the book and then, you know, worked on it to edit it and buff it up and get it ready to be published. But I was very fortunate to find a publisher.
Yeah, but how was the juggling act for you in terms of you were still working, or did you take time off from your
No, I still was working full time. I did the program in part time, so I had a class, you know, two classes at a time, usually in the evenings. You know, it was a pretty busy time. I was we were eating a lot of takeout at my house during that period of time. But you know, I like to write, and I've been writing a lot. I would write about my patients and things that happened, and so that part was. I enjoyed it, and more I would write in the morning, get up an hour or two early and write in the morning. Usually in the evening I'd be kind of pooped, you know, be trying to find the time was sometimes an effort. But, you know, it was something that I really wanted to do and wanted to see through to the end, so I was very happy that I got that done.
Congratulations. It was a big feat. But you have a determination to do it, and that's part of, you know, we always talk about you have to find the way and you have to find the time and you have to commit to it. Once you commit to it, I think, and once you're in it, then there's no stopping you. It's that part where you're on it, where it could go either way. I always say, like, when I start a project, I'm like, well, yeah, it's early. It could go either way. Either I'm going to push through it or it's going to fall by the wayside. So you push through
like
it.
Like so many
things. Remarkable...
Yeah, like so many things, yeah.
It's a remarkable book. I'm sure it's been well received so far. I mean, it just came out recently, but I think I'm sure a lot of people will appreciate these stories. Have your colleagues read it, and what's their take on it, and any of your patients?
My colleagues, several of my colleagues have read it, and they come into my door and they want to know who's which patient I'm talking about or which nurse I'm talking about. But they're very, it's gratifying really for me because they come in and say, oh my gosh, it just put me right back in that moment. And other people who've read it who are not even in medicine but remember that time and or had a friend or a family member or someone who was affected by it, it is gratifying when they say, oh, I just remember this aspect or this feeling or this way things were. It really resonates with them. So that's been very, I've had really very, very positive response, which has been so nice. My colleagues, I think, are also glad that I wrote it for the same reason that I'm glad I wrote it, just because it was such a unique time, not only for our clinic specifically and me personally, but also really in the history of the epidemic, in the history of the country, really. That period of time in the 90s was so transformative in how we could take care of these patients.
Really powerful, really important. Did you take notes all the way through, or you just referred back to your notes and used your memory to remember, you know, different...
I guess a little bit, in the sense just that, as I say, you know, some of the patients were such characters, so I would just go home sometimes at night and write a paragraph or two about, not even thinking I was going to write a book, but so I had some, you know, sort of journal type stuff that I had collected over the years, and also with my colleagues, I said, you know, is there anything that stands out that you remember? And they might bring up a given patient of theirs or something that happened that I'd be like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. So they helped me with it as well.
It's a fascinating book. It's an intriguing read, and I think it's also very life-affirming because, as I said, these people went through so many struggles and still had a great humanity, great humor, great grace about so many of them, and you do them justice, I think, which is nice.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, that was in the band. Yeah, go ahead.
I just was going to say again. I felt really fortunate because it was such an intense time, and there was so much sadness. But the patients were so remarkable and special. Some, you know, some were infuriating, but some were just amazing. And my colleagues really, you know, we really helped each other. So it was a very special time.
We have a nice legacy really for them. I think that's what it is. It's a legacy for all those patients and the hardworking professionals that you worked side by side with. Voices in the Band is the book. Dr. Susan Ball is the author. Thanks so much. Congratulations on the book and all the great work you're doing and have done and continue to do. If people want to find the book, you have a website, correct? It's
SusanBallMD.com, yes, and or on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or the Cornell University Press website. You can get it there, too.
All the usual suspects. Okay.
The usual, yeah.
Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you so much, and good luck with it, and I hope you come back and see us again.
Thanks so much, Amy. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Find out more again, as I said, Dr. Susan Ball, MD. You'll find out more about her book, Voices in the Band. It is the end of the Thorquist Show. Lots to talk about. Get into the mix. A.B. writes on the Twitter feed, phone line 347-857-4505. Doctors working in the trenches in the AIDS movement. And once again, we thank Dr. Susan Ball for stopping by. The website, I should mention, it's SusanBallMD.com. I'll post it for you, too, after the show. The book is Voices in the Band, really a poignant look at some of those patients and the early struggles in AIDS treatment. But it'll also be applied to the folks in Baltimore. Big developments happening out there, as you probably have heard. They have issued 6 arrest warrants for the police officers involved in the arrest, which has been considered and called an illegal arrest by the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, who has, I guess, become an instant hero among so many people, came out forcefully. What a tough cookie. She is a young woman who took charge of this investigation, said she worked with the police and her own investigators to independently investigate. Yesterday there was word they were damping down the expectations of the crowd by saying, we don't think this information will be revealed tomorrow, as originally had reported. But not only was the report came out, although they didn't release all the evidence, but she just definitively did issue arrest warrants, which are even better for the crowd and for social justice, and said that, yeah, I mean, there were some charges, a slew of charges against 6 officers, including the top charge, I think, was second-degree depraved depraved heart murder, I think is what they call it, against the driver of the police van. Because apparently she outlined it. I heard the press conference statement earlier today where she outlines pretty much what they did. They kept stopping. They checked on him a few times. He was in distress, but they didn't do anything about it. I mean, how do you do that? Of course, she also indicated that the arrest itself was illegal, which most people were wondering about. Why was this young man, Freddie Gray, arrested to begin with? Because he looked askance at a cop and he ran away. He did have a knife on him, but apparently it was a small knife, which is legal to have in the city of Baltimore, the state of Maryland. It was not a switchblade, as originally had been reported. I hadn't even known that that was what they were contending. And whether or not he had some known drug ties, criminal ties, who knows? That may be true, but you still can't just arrest people for no probable cause on the spot based on what your past notions are. But what really was reprehensible, it seems, and again, we have to wait for this to play out. Everybody's innocent until proven guilty. But why they didn't restrain him properly with the seatbelt in the van, number one, and why did they keep checking on him and then doing nothing when he was clearly in distress? So that's going to be a lot to answer for. We'll see what happens, how it plays out. She did call. She said, "I heard your pleas for, you know, no justice, no peace." And she says, "You're getting your justice. You know, give it time, but I ask for your peace, because this is, you know, you have to let it play out, and let's hope that, you know, calm can be restored to Baltimore and across the country." But, you know, peaceful protests are okay. I had this discussion yesterday with someone who said, well, you know, they're not doing any good, they're not helping things. Well, the violent protests, the violent demonstrations, the rioting, the looting, the destruction of property in their own communities, that's certainly not helping anybody, and I agree. But peaceful protests is what changed the world and changed a lot of things in this country. And continues to do it, and continues to be needed, because clearly there are underlying problems. But they have to get away from that violent response, that's for sure. Reach out to us here at AB Rights, the Twitter feed, phone line, too, if you're listening live on Friday, May 1st, 347-857-4505. And, you know, tell us your take on the Baltimore situation and anything else, by the way. Interesting, some of the responses that people have had. Daniel says, "One woman just did more to calm the streets of Baltimore than an entire hyper-militarized police force ever could. Hashtag Freddie Gray." Yeah, indeed. She was definitely a tough young woman. She's, I think, 35 years old, but very forceful. Seemed a little nervous at first when she was reading her statement because of all the swarm of press and knowing the gravity of what she was talking about and the charges that were being issued. But she got into her stride as she went and seems like a very competent person. There was some question, I think, you know, that when they had it, she took a few questions from the press, and I didn't quite hear exactly what it was, but I figured it out, I think, pieced together, that her husband is involved in the legislature. I don't know if it's the city council or something in the city or in the state of Maryland, because somebody said about a conflict of interest, and she said, "No, he's a legislator. He makes the laws. I uphold the laws." And other people also, another question about, I guess there was some noise that some people, some protesters, some activists were making about having a special prosecutor, and should you have a special prosecutor, because it's hard for the prosecutors who work hand in hand with the police to prosecute their own colleagues, essentially. And she said, "No, they elected me, and I'm doing my job." And she's doing her job because she is indeed charging these people. So it's fascinating. Rebecca says, "Wow, Marilyn Mosby is fierce." Mm-hmm. Yeah, she sure is. Your take, let us know. And, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out this weekend. A lot of things are being you know, are being planned this weekend, a lot of protests throughout the Northeast and other places, too. So we'll see if they're all peaceful as a result of at least some positive movement, the way people would think about them. Reach out if you have any comments. AB Rights is the place on the Twitter feed and, of course, the phone line. I'll cling those tin cans in a string together for me, please, 347-857-4505. Charlie chiming in saying, hopefully it will be peaceful and some results will be seen. Yeah, okay, we'll see. We hope, indeed. Today, by the way, we talk about unrest and protest marks a sad day in American history. It's the 45th, well, not today, it's actually next week, May 4th, is the 45th anniversary of Kent State, the massacre at Kent State when four students were gunned down by the National Guard during a demonstration protesting the Vietnam War. In 2010, the site of the Kent State University shootings was placed on the National Register of Historic Places by the Department of Interior with support of the Ohio Preservation Office. So it's if you see those images, and I'm too young to remember those images. A little younger than Dr. Ball, and I don't remember a lot of that, some of that very, very early stuff in the AIDS movement, but I don't remember the Vietnam War at all, except the images are still preserved. You know, and as a very young little kid, you'd see some of the stuff on the news. But it's indelibly etched as one of the injustices in American history. Putting it in perspective for us, a little more from Bill Curtis.
As passionately as World War II had united Americans in common cause, the Vietnam conflict set Americans against each other. Fanning those divisions, President Nixon referred to student demonstrators as bums, while his vice president, Spiro Agnew, advised police to just imagine they are wearing brown shirts or white sheets and act accordingly. On May 4th, 1970, Agnew got his wish. The Kent State Massacre began as one among hundreds of protests taking place on college campuses around the country that weekend, sparked by President Nixon's televised announcement to widen the Vietnam War by launching airstrikes inside the borders of neutral Cambodia. Fully armed but inexperienced National Guard units were put into service to quell the demonstrations. Suddenly, the smell of smoke and the sound of gunfire split the air. A local reporter witnessed the whole tragic event.
At the request of the Portage County prosecutor, an injunction has been imposed by County Judge Albert Karras, barring all persons from the KSU campus except those specifically authorized by the Ohio National Guard. The injunction requires all students living on campus to depart as soon as possible and at the latest by 12 noon tomorrow. At this point, the majority of students have left the campus and many are awaiting rides from parents and friends. The injunction has been imposed as a result of this weekend's campus disorders. This afternoon, four persons, including two women, were shot and killed on the campus during renewed demonstrations involving hundreds of students.
Members of the National Guard units at Kent State had fired loaded weapons without warning into crowds of anti-war protesters. A similar incident 10 days later claimed two more lives at Jackson State University in Mississippi. In the fevered aftermath of the shootings, a presidential commission was formed and concluded that the National Guard's action of firing into the crowd was unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable. But however one viewed the tragedy, one conclusion seemed inescapable. The war had come home.
Soldiers and Nixon coming. We're finally on our own. soldiers and Nixon coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. Forget it.
Anthems of the Vietnam era, Neil Young's Ohio, done up, of course, with his colleagues from Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. On the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, as we commemorate that sad upcoming 45th anniversary of the tragedy at Kent State.
Wow.
Flash forward 45 years, there's unrest in the streets. Now, from Ferguson to Staten Island to South Carolina to Baltimore, all across the country, protesting police brutality, poverty, injustice, inequality, and all of those things sometimes bubbling over in violence, hopefully today damped down by a very tenacious young state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, and six arrests of police officers in the tragic death of Freddie Gray. Details to follow, of course, and stay tuned as hopefully whatever protests continue will be peaceful. Weigh in, A.B. Wrights is the place. Dondi chiming in about Kent State. Remember it as a teenager. You're right, the images are forever etched in our minds. Yeah, I mean, so powerful, that photographic image of those kids, those young people lying dead on the ground.
Wow,
amazing. And that song, too, very, very powerful. Some tough stuff, and we have to own up to it because there are some albatrosses around our American history and whitewashing it, pretending they didn't happen, that's not the answer. You got to own it, got to face it, got to move forward and keep doing better or trying to do better. It's an ongoing process. America and all of us are a work in progress, I guess, is the best way to describe it. It is the Free Flow Pop Culture Convo on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wrights, phone line 347-857-4505. So Bernie Sanders, he says he's in. The fiery independent senator from Vermont says he's in the race. And he plans to win. That's what he says. It's interesting. We'll see. Obviously, it looks like he's going to run in the Democratic primary as a challenge to push Hillary Clinton towards the left. But we'll see, because he's officially an independent. He's never really been affiliated officially with the Democrats, although he aligns himself and votes with them in Congress. And we had this discussion since I posted the question yesterday afternoon with various folks about, is this a good thing to have him enter the race for Hillary or a bad thing? I guess it's a double-edged sword, but a couple of folks have chimed in. Nameless Cynic says, well, if he runs as an independent, that's bad. But as a centrist, Hillary needs a primary challenge to keep her a little farther left. I would agree. Don't pull a Nader on us. Don't go all Nader on us, Bernie, because then you'll wind up like 2000 with the Supremes handing the presidency to George W. Bush away from its rightful winner and the man who won the popular vote, Al Gore. I mean, remember that, right? We're all on the same page. And nobody who's listening is not old enough to remember that one. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. He's definitely a character. The other thing I wonder, though, if people will take on Bernie Sanders' age, or are they just all upset about Hillary Clinton being too old and golden girly like Mitch McConnell, who I think is 73 or 74. Hillary, by the way, 67. Bernie Sanders, 73. So, you know, for me, go for it. I don't think, you know, if you have your, you're on the right page in terms of issues and you're healthy enough and you're vigorous enough and you've got to be healthy and vigorous to make a national campaign run, that's for sure. I'm not in the ages category, but don't do ageism against only the female candidate versus the male candidate, if you know what I mean. But to be fair, people did take on Ronald Reagan and said he was too old when he ran at 69. People took on John McCain, who was 72, I guess, right? It's not just for women, but they do seem to perseverate at Hillary, and the fact that Mitch McConnell makes me laugh particularly because he's older than she is, that, you know, the Democratic side looks like a rerun of the Golden Girls. But Hillary is much more forward-thinking, of course, and Bernie Sanders, many would say, is even more forward-thinking than whoever is on the Republican side, including people like Marco Rubio, who is 43 and talks about a new generation of leaders and moving America forward. But his ideas are so retro, it's ridiculous. You know, it doesn't match. The propaganda doesn't match with what it is you're actually going after. That's my take. What about you? Bernie in, Bernie out. Is it a good thing? Is it not such a good thing? Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright's phone line, 347-857-4505. And I do want to pay a little tribute to Joni Mitchell. There's been some conflicting stories this week about the folk rock pop icon, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and her health. You know, she fell ill a few weeks back. People were speculating she's in a coma, she's unresponsive, she's at the hospital. And it came a bigger deal and more caution and concern just the other day when a friend of hers had applied for conservatorship over her. But apparently there was a, we can find it, the statement they made that she's definitely still humming along, so to speak. Let's see, do we have it, Trudy? Can we find it? There's so many things going on today where it's definitely live radio without a net in a major way. With the system threatening to crash at any moment, so we'll hope for the best here. Yeah, they say she's alert and not in a coma, according to her official website. Here is the statement on the website. We don't have it. She was found unconscious back on March 31st, and they said, according to the website, that she was on the mend. I don't have the exact statement. Okay, I thought we did. All right, anyway, but they say that she is not in a coma. She is alert, and the friend just took out the conservatorship as a precaution. So we're wishing her the best, Joni Mitchell, a true icon, and we hope for the best. Here's one of her classics. Hi, Oak. Hey, New Yorkers, this one's for you.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studio, and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out a broodmare's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my real cereal. Just tacos to the bone and the skin and the eyes and a little you can get. Run driver, no, no, racing away. You just picked up a hitcher, cruising around the white lines on the freeway. You saw a farmhouse burning down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. We roll right past that tragedy till we turned into some roadhouse light where a local band was playing. Locals were up kicking and shaking on the floor. The next thing I know, that coyote's at my door. Pins me in a corner, he won't take no. Drags me out on the dance floor and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got a woman at home. He's got another woman down the hall. He seems so funny anyway. Why'd you have to get so drunk and leave me on that way? You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. On the roads about Jenny near my old hometown, he went running through the whisker weed, chasing some pride down, and a hawk was playing with him. Coyote was jumping straight up and making passes, and the same eyes just like yours, under your dark glasses, privately probing a public room, peeking through keyholes and numbered doors, where the players lick their wounds and take their temporary lovers and their pills and powders to get them through this fashion thing. No regrets, Coyote. Let's just get off a boat. You just picked up a hitcher, prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. Watching the waitress's legs, he's too far.
people at this party, they've got a lot of style. They've got fans of many countries, they've got passport smiles. Some are friendly, some are cutting, some are watching it from the wings. Some are standing in the center, giving a gift song free. Photo beauty gets attention, and her eye paint's running down. She's got a rose in her teeth and a lampshade crown. One minute she's so happy, then she's crying on someone's knee, saying, laughing and crying, you know it's the same release. I told you when I met you I was crazy. Cry for a soul, beauty. Cry for Eddie in the corner, thinking he's nobody. And Jack behind his joker, and Stone Cold Grace behind her fan. And me and my pride in silence, thinking I don't understand. I feel like I'm sleeping. Can you wake me? You seem to have a broader sensibility. I'm just living on nerves and feelings, with a weak and a lazy mind. And coming to people's parties, fumbled and deaf, dumb and blind. I wish I had more sense of humor, keeping the sadness at bay, throwing the lightness on these things, laughing it all away.
Party is Joni Mitchell from her masterpiece Court and Spork, one of several, and not too many artists can say that. And of course, Coyote, which I send out to my friends in New York City who have enjoyed various Coyote spottings over the last few weeks. No urban myth, but we're not sure if it's the same Coyote or several Coyotes. They take on the urban landscape. Joni Mitchell, under the weather, ailing, but not in a coma, says her official website. In fact, we just found the statement, this is it, posted yesterday. Contrary to rumors circulating on the internet, Joni is not in a coma. Joni is still in the hospital, but she comprehends, she's alert, and she has her full senses. A full recovery is expected. The document obtained by a certain media outlet, I think it was TMZ, simply gives her longtime friend Leslie Morris the authority, in the absence of 24-hour doctor care, to make care decisions for Joni once she leaves the hospital. As we all know, Joni is a strong-willed woman and is nowhere near giving up the fight. Please continue to keep Joni in your thoughts. You may add your well wishes to her at the website weloveyoujoni.com, and lots of people have chimed in there. Bianca Jagger, for instance, says, "My dear Joni, I just wanted to let you know that I'm thinking of you and praying for your speedy recovery. We love you, Joni, indeed." Cassandra Wilson says, it is we who are asleep and await your voice to awaken us. We love you, Joni." Wow. So lots of people, famous and not so famous, are chiming in on their love for Joni Mitchell and what her music has meant for people for so long, and I will chime in on that too. She has been a real influence, and just love her music for years. She crosses generations. I worked at a radio station doing a morning drive shift, which, as I think I mentioned, it's not a natural thing for me to get up that early, but I did it because I love radio. I dragged myself in there, and we had a big blown-up head of Joni Mitchell face right there on the big window, and that would imbue me with some interesting, complicated, lively energy to get through the show. So Joni Mitchell, get well soon, please. You've got some great music out there and some great supporters indeed. So if you want to chime in your love of Joni Mitchell, you can do so at weloveyoujoni.com or just do it on Twitter or wherever you post your social media commentary, and it will get picked up, I'm sure. We wish her the best. Free Flow Pop Culture Convo in full swing on a Friday at the Twitter feed at AB Writes. Phelps chiming in, wow. You really go from one topic to the next without any problem. You go, girl. Well, thank you, Phelps. It's a juggling act, especially on a day like today. Jay's chiming in. Another great interview, intriguing guest, and I like the other topics, too, and the way you handle it. All right. Well, thank you so much. I try. We try. Not always successful, but we do try. Hey, speaking of trying, let's go to our Inspiration Action Challenge success story shout-out. I want to mention Harvey in where is Harvey from? Somewhere in Pennsylvania, we think, I believe, who says he's working on some artwork, sculpture, paintings, and the like. That's how he describes it. Okay, Harvey, good luck to you. And he says, it really got me spurred on. Actually, writing compliments the artwork in ways I never thought it would. So thank you for getting me going with the journaling. It has really helped. I appreciate it so much. Well, you're very welcome, Harvey. I'm glad it's working for you. Good luck with all the artwork and the like. And let us know how you progress. And if the Inspiration Action Challenge has worked for you, hey, please reach out to the website, amybetharkowee.com. Tell me about it. I'll give you a well-deserved shout-out. I think it also helps nudge other folks on. And on the other hand, if you need a little cajoling, hey, let's start that creativity coaching conversation you've been putting off. Again, the website is amybetharkowee.com, and we'll help get you out of that creative ditch. Give me a week or so to get back to you, and we'll get you going, hopefully, in the right direction. As simple as that. Well, it's not simple, but we get started. You know, how inspiring was Dr. Susan Ball, who, you know, full-time physician working in a very high-pressure, stressful profession and circumstances dealing with AIDS patients and still found time. It took her a while. I mean, she admits about 10 years or so to get this book done, but she did it and chronicled her work, her very important work, and the patients that she has helped in a great book called Voices in the Band. So if she can pull it off, I think you can do it too. So that's inspiring to all of us. Speaking of inspirations, the Sackler Center for Feminist Art is honoring a slew of people, figures, I should say. Miss Piggy is among the ranks of former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Tony Award-winning director Julie Taymor, attorney and professor Anita Hill, and other extraordinary women who have been honored by the Elizabeth A. Sackler Center for Feminist Art as being first in their respective fields. The center, which opened at the Brooklyn Museum in 2007, made this announcement on Tuesday that this year's first award will be presented to the famous and feisty Muppet. The recipients are all symbols in addition to being extraordinary intelligent leaders, so says Elizabeth Sackler, who founded the center in 2014 and became the first female board chair of the Brooklyn Museum and the cultural institution's 200-year history. Anita Hill has become a symbol. Miss Piggy has, too, the same way Gloria Steinem has. Sackler identifies as a public historian, social arts activist, and American Indian advocate, according to the center's website. Miss Piggy, Sackler goes on to say, overcomes obstacles. She's certainly first of her kind. She's got grit. She's tenacious. But she also has that soft spot, the love of Kermit. The character was introduced back in the 70s, has all the qualities that women need to have to face the world as it is, and she gives us a good smile on top of it all. Sackler also points out that while Miss Piggy's beloved Kermit the Frog has received several awards and is honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Miss Piggy has yet to garner an equivalent list of accolades. Really, Miss Piggy doesn't have a star and Kermit does? That is a scandal we really have to work on. Kermit and Miss Piggy have been very much a part of my children's generations' lives and as a result a part of mine, says Sackler, explaining that her own children grew up with the Muppets on both TV and movie screens. I have always seen all of the Muppets as extraordinary examples and incredible characters that teach all people, including children, of course, about the different aspects of life, the great parts, the hard parts, the challenges, and the beauties. Okay. So Miss Piggy is being honored. I think that is so great. I just find that wonderful and fascinating, and I know our pal Aurora from the TCS crew is so thrilled. She's doing a jig, and she found this wonderful little item from Miss Piggy. Give it a listen.
This song is dedicated to my dearest Kermie and my friend, the late, great Judy Garland. And all because of the frog that hopped away. No more his eager croak or telling a toad joke. The dreams you dreamed and spoke are astray. Hopped off and to ruffle, it will and topple with you first.
I'm on my way.
Friday on our mind since Monday. It's like kind of a week. That's Easy Beats. We made it on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Mellencamp, so I'm not running anymore. And with apologies to Judy Garland, Miss Piggy and the Frog That Hopped Away. Miss Piggy receiving a big honor at the Sackler Center for Feminist Art, side by side with Julie Taymor, Anita Hill, and Sandra Day O'Connor. Aurora's thrilled. I know that. You gotta love it. You just got it. Crazy day, busy Twitter feed at AB Writes. Nixie, one of our hearty regulars, chiming in. Hey, another great show, AB. Thank you, Nixie. She writes, you really ran the gamut. Great interview, good commentary, and I love the music. Well, there you go, Nixie. Thank you so much. Hey, if you missed the show or any of the shows, they're all archived for podcast. Don't forget to follow the Amy Beth Arkley Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. You can download episodes there, also at iTunes, NetNow, and at my website, amybetharkley.com. Where you can peruse my stories, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, the Eliza Gordon Mysteries, are available via Cozy Cat Press for Kindle and paperback. And for today and tomorrow only, May 1st and May 2nd, Kindle buyers, you'll find a very tantalizing surprise. So check it out. Today and tomorrow only, May 1st and May 2nd. By the way, Mother's Day is coming up. If mom's a mystery lover, these books make great reads, so just check it out. And thanks so much to folks who are helping me get the word out about Killing Time. Again, as you know, we made the transition from our old publisher, Hen House Press, to Cozy Cat Press with the new revised edition of the book. And in making the transition, a lot of our reviews got lost in the translation, so to speak. And I noted yesterday that somebody managed to post a very nice new complimentary review on the Killing. They somehow got it on the old page, which I don't know how that happened, but the reviews got lost in translation. But there is somebody who's trying to sell an old copy of the paperback, the original paperback, original version, for $999 on Amazon. So I don't know. I don't think I'm getting any royalties from that if it should sell. Strange stuff happening out there, but okay. But do thank you so much for your reviews and getting the word out. I appreciate it. And for Dead Silent as well, which is a finalist in the Mystery and Mayhem Awards. So, read on. And if you got a mom who loves mysteries, Mother's Day is around the corner. I'm sure she'll enjoy it as well. Enough of the self-promotion. Onward we go. Tomorrow, May 2nd, is also the Run for the Roses, the Kentucky Derby. I know, it just sneaks up on you every year. Will we have a triple crown? We haven't had one in, a long time. Well, the Kentucky Derby experts have weighed in. I don't know how they do this, and I'm not a bettor myself, although I think this year they have an app out that you can use to make bets if you're not at the Derby. I'm not sure how that works. I'm not into it. I'm not doing it. But just so you know, if you want to troll around the Internet to find it, you may do that. But here it is. These are the top picks, according to the experts, how they figured it out, based on past performance, I guess, and hunches. American Pharoah is the number one pick. Dortmund, number two. Carpe Diem, number three. Frosted, number four. Mubtaj. Number five, I'm sure I'm messing up that pronunciation. Condo Commando, some people picking. Oh, this is the other group. Okay, there are two different groups. Stellar Wind, I'm a Chatterbox, Lovely Maria, and Bird at the Wire. So those are two different experts picking their picks. I don't know anything about it, but I know it's a glorious day. It's over in a flash, but there's a lot of hoopla and pomp and circumstance attached to it, including a lot of crazy hats and mint julep drinking, and we hope the weather holds. I don't know what the forecast is, but it's an elegant day, and we're off to the races with the first of the Triple Crown. Here's Dan Fogelberg and Run for the Roses. I'm Amy Beth Arkowicz, and I love this song, too, which helps.
Now join America's most popular show already in progress.
Give it to me. one tally, had a big trap game going back in the alley. And I kept rolling them sevens and winning all them pots. My luck was so good, I could do no wrong. I just kept on rolling and controlling them bones. Finally, they just threw up their hand and said, when you hot, you hot. I said, yeah.
When you're hot, you're hot. And when you're not, you're not.
Something behind me. I turned around and there was a big old cop. He said, hello, boys. Then he gave us a grin and said, look like I'm gonna have to haul y'all in and keep all that money for evidence. I said, well, son, when you hot, you hot. He said, yeah,
when you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You can explain it all down at City Hall. I said, yeah,
when
you're
hot,
hot, you're hot. Buddy that I recognized, I said, hey, Judge, old buddy, old pal, I'll pay you that $100 if you get me out of this spot. So he gave my friends a little fine to pay. He turned around and grinned at me and said, 90 days, Jerry, when you hot, you hot. And I said, thanks a lot.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
He let my friends go free and throw the book at me. He said, well, when you're hot, you're hot. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing, Judge, old buddy, old pal, if you wouldn't wear that black robe,
when you're not, you're not. Trudy rolled that one out for the New York Mets on the Amy the Third Week Show. They started out so hot. No, not so much, but they'll get there. They'll battle back. You'll see. And also CCR's Traveling Dan Fogelberg's Beauty Run for the Roses for the Kentucky Derby on the Amy Beth Arkui Show. Speaking of CCR, John Fogerty was on Letterman the other night. They had Hootie and the Blowfish. How fabulous was that last night? Did you see it? Singing Hold Your Hand, the song they debuted back in 1994 on the same stage. Letterman rolling out a lot of his favorites as the show winds down the end of this month. Wow. Letterman, Mad Men. I heard Don Imus is wrapping it up, too. So a lot of iconic fixtures going by the wayside on TV. Anyway, he had Mellencamp, John Mellencamp, on earlier in the week. Mellencamp comes out. You know, Mellencamp is more from the angry young man to the crusty old guy, like Letterman. He comes out with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. Both Mellencamp and Letterman, of course, had heart attacks. So Mellencamp, back in his early 40s, he's still kicking around in his 60s. And he says, Dave writes a little piece of paper on a piece of paper, hands it to him, and says, there's a Surgeon General's phone number. And he says, well, after your heart attack, did your doctor tell you to keep smoking? And he said, well, there are a few things I do well. Smoking is my strong suit. I also write a few good songs, and I have a great first kiss, which I thought was incongruous to the smoking, because who wants to kiss an ashtray, John? But okay, it works for him. I love Mellencamp, and love Letterman now that he's on his way out. It's fun to reminisce about some of the old great that were on his show. So some good stuff. I guess we're getting ready to wrap things up. Is that true?
Goodbye, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. We're back tomorrow with another show.
Well, unless we're fired, we'll talk to you then. Goodbye, sweetheart. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Been there, done that, but not this time. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate the comments on the lively Twitter feed, especially since most folks listen on podcasts. You can check out all the details at the website, amybetharkawi.com. Friend me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, 24/7 AB Writes, and you can follow our producer, Trudy Hart, at Radio Trudy. Thank you, Trudy, Aurora, ML at TCS headquarters. And by the way, Britain and the whole world is on the big Kate wait, Royal Baby Watch. The Duchess of Cambridge is 9 days overdue, so we'll wrap things up with Simon and Garfunkel's Baby Driver. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. Hey, please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkui Show. Take care.